Welcome to Season 3 of Title Nerds, presented by the law firm of Riker Danzig. Each episode features Riker Danzig's thought leaders in the title insurance law space, discussing current legal trends and issues of significance. Nothing shared on today's podcast should be considered legal advice in any particular matter. Now I'll turn it over to our co-hosts, partners Michael O'Donnell and Bethany Abley.
Welcome everyone to Season 3 of Title Nerds. I'm Mike O'Donnell, and I'm with my co-host Bethany Abley. We're both partners at Riker Danzig, and we've been doing this podcast for 2 years now. It seems like only yesterday. If you hear a two-year-old in the background of this podcast, it's simply because I'm on alert to babysit my grandson if my daughter goes into labor. With that, we'll turn to title insurance. And we're really happy today because we honestly have one of the foremost experts in the nation in title insurance, Bush Nielsen. Bush is out of Wisconsin, and he's written a treatise that every title insurance lawyer or real estate lawyer should look at and review. I've had Bush as a consultant in one of my cases, and I've had Bush as an expert on one of my cases. So Bush, we're really excited to have you and for you to give our audience tips and advice as to what to do when hiring and working with experts all the way from the initial retention through trial.
Thank you for inviting me, Mike and Bethany, and for your kind words.
And before we got started today, Mike, I was actually telling Bush, I'm fangirling a little bit here because for all of you listeners at home, hopefully if you're a title nerd, you know Mr. Nielsen, you know our guest today. And I know personally, I have Title and Escrow Claims Guide by Mr. Nielsen on my desk right now. So hopefully all of you at home listening have it as well. And we're going to have a great day today. And again, Bush, thank you so much for being on with us today.
It's my pleasure. The only thing that is good about a book, a research text especially, is to have people read it. So thank you.
And we definitely do. We definitely use it. And I know mine's got marked up with pencil. It's not my own personal copy. It's the firm's copy. So I've got pencil mark underlines that I can then erase if need be, if the library starts yelling at me. But I've got tabs in it. I've got post-it notes in it. So it has definitely come in handy. And we thank you for that.
And Bush, we can tell you here in New Jersey, we refer to you as the out-of-state guy, as good as Larry Feinberg, which is the highest compliment Jersey guys can give.
Yes, thank you.
So I guess the first thing we want to talk about this morning is how do you go about finding an expert and what are some tips you have when an attorney is initially retaining an expert? Can you tell us some guidelines and tips for the attorneys looking for experts out there?
Yes, well, there are not many experts on the subject of title, for example. So you really have to dig, and don't be afraid to look for someone who is out of state, at least on a subject that is universal. Particularly, for example, industry custom and practice, or the words in a title insurance policy, which is, of course, universal around the country. Beyond that, however, I think it is very difficult to figure out who to find as an expert, at least on title, or on title examination, or on escrow and closing. On certain subjects, you need to be looking for someone who is local, if there is one. If not, you go to someone who is somewhere in the country and has the credentials to opine. Here's what I would do in interviewing an expert. I would ask the person, have you testified before? How many times have you testified? In what context? Where have you testified? Have your opinions been excluded or limited? And then please describe for me exactly in what way. That doesn't mean that the person is unqualified if the person's opinions have been excluded or limited. You need to know why. Does this person have what the other side would view as a conflict of interest in that the person has some other relationship with the title insurer that is involved in this case or the title agent, whatever the company it is, so that there seems to be some economic relationship between the expert and that company already. As to title insurance specifically, I would ask, do you testify for and against title insurers? If so, how often and what is the proportion? Everyone seems to want to know that. And then I think here's the most important question. I would ask some specific questions that get to the question of whether or not the expert knows what you need to have that person know. And I would not refrain at all from asking pinpoint questions about what this person knows and what is the source or basis of that information, not opinion, but information. I would also try to figure out right away, is this person a procrastinator? Now, this is beyond the interview process, but I have been involved in a number of cases, and I have seen a number of deadlines kicked simply because an expert procrastinated. That is a very bad thing all the way around, and you don't want a procrastinator.
I will say I've experienced that. I know there was once I had an expert who got me the initial draft report very late at night on the eve of the deadline. And it was one of those things where you looked at it and said, wait a minute, sir, we told you months ago the deadline. How am I getting it now? And as the attorney waiting for the expert, there's only so much you can do when the expert's delaying in giving you the report. So that's a good point. Definitely a good point. At what point in the process, you know, if we have a litigation, at what point in the process do you recommend usually starting to search for the expert? Is it something that you recommend doing on early on, the beginning of the case, the middle of the case, when you've got the expert report deadline looming? At what point do you recommend bringing in an expert?
I would do it early for this reason. If this person is an expert, the person will have thoughts about the case. And before the case gets shaped as to what the lawyers, especially the opposing lawyer, believes to be the issues, allow the expert to weigh in as to the facts and then what the expert sees as being the valid issues in the case and what the expert's opinions would be on those subjects. It may help you in shaping your view of the case. And by the way, I have been a trial lawyer for many years, and it has always been my opinion that a good lawyer is one who does not allow the other side's shaping of issues to control the case. The other lawyer may know nothing about the subject and may be guessing about the issues. So you need to shape the issues in the case for the court so that you're talking about the right issues. The expert can help you to do that. Also, it can be super awkward if you want to hire an expert late in the game and the expert says, gee, the way this case has been pled or argued so far isn't really in line with what I would have as opinions about what industry custom is or what, say, underwriters do in the underwriting of insurance. So if you hire the expert late in the game, it's too late to make the expert's opinions really gel with the way the case has been handled so far. Now, you can tell the expert, I want you to give me your sort of initial opinions, and then I want you to stop. And the expert should then stop. Most people seem to hire experts late for two reasons. One, the lawyer is a little tardy in getting at it. The lawyer might be a procrastinator. Or the lawyer is worried that the expert is going to spin a lot of wheels and bill a lot of time in the case if hired early. So just hire the expert early, tell that person to stop.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think one of the things that you were talking about with the ideas the expert might have, I think it's so important if you have an expert come in and look at things. And as you said, the theory of the case that you might have, the expert might have a different theory of the case, or it might be something where the expert thought of something you didn't think of. Do you have any examples, any war stories where that happened with you when you were serving as an expert? And you came in and said, wait a minute.
Yes, actually, the thing that recurs is issues about recorded instruments that do not affect title. So, for example, there is a notice that has been recorded by a municipality about a building code violation. And everyone has assumed, including, say, the title officer, that because this instrument was recorded, that it was an encumbrance on title. The Michigan Supreme Court just issued a ruling in a case called Galvan, G-A-L-V-A-N versus Poon, P-O-O-N, saying that Michigan adopts the majority principle that a building code violation is not an encumbrance on title. So if you have a recorded notice about a violation, it's not an encumbrance on title. What flows from that is the insured may say, well, because you missed the recorded instrument about the building code violation, I now have coverage for the thing missed. But if that instrument was not an encumbrance on title, there is no coverage, whether or not there is an exception for that instrument. So that's something that you should work out early on and make sure that you're on the same page with as to the expert.
Before I turn it over to Mike to talk about the report itself, do you have any procedural tips for us when you're hiring an expert? I know we talked about a few things about the initial retention and finding the expert. Any other procedural tips that you could recommend for attorneys when we're out there hiring the expert?
Well, I think the first important thing is tell the expert how you want the expert to communicate with you. That may depend on whether or not communications of a certain kind are discoverable. Also, tell the expert whether or not draft report of sent by email is discoverable, or if you want the report to be sent that way in draft form. And so that would mean that you have to know the rules as to this case. The other is tell the expert when the trial is, if the trial date has been set. I was involved in a case in which opposing counsel told the opposing expert the wrong week for trial. And so the expert had a week blocked off on his calendar, but it was the wrong week. When they got close to trial, they realized that the expert would be in Europe the week of the trial. And so they had to go with his videotaped testimony, which I think is less persuasive, of course.
And it could have been avoided if the attorney gave him the right date.
Exactly.
You know, Bush, before we get to the report, what you said about the building, recorded building violations not being in the coverage of the title, I found it sort of interesting. I just want to make sure I understand it. You know, I'm familiar that there's not coverage for zoning unless there's a violation of zoning laws that's recorded and identified and searchable by what the title policy defines as the public records. I see that with condemnation as well. That would not be the case with That wasn't the case with the building violation in this Galvin case?
Oh, in the Galvin case, the Supreme Court was deciding whether or not a building code violation was an encumbrance on title. Now, under the 2006 and 2021 policies, if there is a recorded notice of violation or enforcement, then there is a limited coverage as to that notice. So you have helped me clarify what I was saying. Just that there are a number of instruments that get recorded that are mere notices about the status of the governmental regulation of the property. Now, for example, there can be a notice saying that the property is in a planned unit development. That's a zoning issue. And that's merely notice of as to how the property is zoned. I have seen cases, though, in which the supposed missing of a recorded instrument about a PUD has been deemed to be an encumbrance on title automatically because it was recorded and it wasn't accepted. So you have to do the hard work of deciding, well, is this an encumbrance on title? And in my book, I talk about all the classes of instruments that get recorded but are not encumbrances on title, and with your clarification, are not notices of violation that would trigger covered risks 5 through 8.
Now, to the expert report itself, why don't you take us through the process of how we as attorneys should work with an expert as to drafting his report? One thing I always avoid is writing the report for the expert. I think that's a huge mistake. But I know sometimes it happens. I think that's hopefully rare. But why don't you take us through the process of how you work with the expert when he's drafting his report and how he presents it to you?
Sure. First, make sure that the expert has all the documents necessary to actually form the opinions and write out a report. In a number of cases, I've had to ask for more documents. Now, in some cases, Those were documents that have not been produced in discovery. But in other cases, I've learned, well, there were documents produced in discovery that I didn't have, and I would never have had them if I hadn't asked. Then I agree with you, Mike. The expert has to write the report. And my process is that I write the report doing all of the tasks involved in the writing of the report. I don't delegate, would not want to delegate any task to anybody else. And I think that's important. Also, if you have comments about the report as the lawyer, go ahead and make your comments or suggestions. The expert may say, thank you for the suggestion. I will not be including your suggestion in my report. But don't be offended. The expert has to defend his or her report and opinions. Also, the report is not argument. It is an explanation of this expert's opinions on these subjects. And often lawyers want me to include argument. And I have to explain, you know, that would suggest that I am writing a brief, and that could lead my report to be excluded. So no thanks. Make sure that the expert understands the standard for expert testimony in this jurisdiction. If it's a federal case under Rule 26, some experts will understand what that standard is, but not all states follow that standard. So the expert has to frame opinions that follow the standard for expert testimony in that jurisdiction so that it actually qualifies as an expert opinion. And don't assume that experts understand that that standard. Make sure that the expert has a reliable method for forming opinions. That is not a simple thing to do. I have seen so many expert reports in which the expert cites no information or standard or basis for opinion or even a textbook. I've seen reports in which people have said, oh, there are textbooks about, say, title insurance, and then they never cite to them. That's a bad idea. The expert should, now I'm thinking about title experts. The title expert should have a reliable source for his or her opinions. Now, you mentioned the Feinberg text in New Jersey. It's a wonderful text and maybe the most in-depth text about title in any state. That's a great source for information about New Jersey practice. Some states have state-specific texts. There are certain texts that are not necessarily reliable on all subjects. And I would put the Palomar book on title insurance in that can, because too much of her book is opinion. I would make sure that the expert does not reach legal conclusions, findings of fact, or get to ultimate issues, particularly if in that jurisdiction, an expert is not allowed to get to those subjects. And so just reading through the report carefully will help you to help the expert not to go too far.
All right. So you've taken us through really a wonderful summary of how to get your expert report in shape and out the door. So your expert report is out the door, and the next thing you get is the opposing expert. And how do we as lawyers use our experts to sort of understand and dissect an opposing expert's report and how it relates to the report we just served?
Well, first, I'd think that practically you should send the opposing expert's report or rebuttal report to your expert as soon as possible. Then you and the expert can be looking at the report at the same time. You don't have to digest it before you send it to the expert. What the expert can do that maybe more quickly even than you as the lawyer can do is to digest what those opinions are, what is lacking in the report, what can be attacked, and also what questions you should be asking that opposing expert in that expert's deposition. That's maybe the most important thing. What questions to ask that expert? The other thing that I look for is, particularly when there is a very well-qualified expert on the other side, what did he or she not talk about in the report? That often is a signal as to opinions that the expert was not willing to give that the lawyer for the other side thinks are issues in the case. And that may show that there is a big gap in their case and the expert understands it. That can lead to questions on that. It's fair game to ask about that in that person's deposition. If your expert has been opposite the opposing expert before, well, just ask, has he or she been? And if so, what do you know about the opposing expert? Do you have prior reports, deposition, motion to exclude, anything about that expert or anything about that person's demeanor or characteristics? I would ask all of that.
And I will note, I've in the past found it very helpful to involve my expert in my preparation for my, you know, deposing the adverse expert. It really has been something I found extremely helpful. And there are many times where my expert will say, you know, focus on this, don't focus on that. And I'll say, well, I've got this great point that I'm going to make. And my expert will say, Bethany, that point's not as great as you think it is. It's not going to get you anywhere. Don't ask that question. Or walk me through something that someone in the field has that expertise that can say to me, hey, focus on this at the depth. You can tear the expert apart on this issue. The issue you were thinking, ask it, but then move on. And also, as you were saying, even reputation in the industry. I mean, obviously, we're in the industry, quote unquote, as attorneys who do this. But sometimes when you're speaking to an expert and they're in a certain industry, they have an inside scoop that you might not have. And I've had experts tell me that as well. Let me give you some feedback about, you know, this person. Here's what their reputation is in the industry. Here's what the word on the street is about this expert that you might not know of as a lawyer. So I've always found it very helpful to talk to my expert about the opposing expert.
Yes. I hired an appraiser once, and he looked at the opposing appraisal report, and he said, oh, they rely on this certain book. That book has been withdrawn from publication because it was inaccurate. Oh, wow. Well, that's a very important thing to know.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Well, look, you've been comprehensive on the reports, so I don't have any further questions on that. I think now we're moving to sort of depositions and trial, and I'll let Bethany sort of quiz you on some of those topics.
Yeah, I guess just from your point of view as the expert, any advice that you have for us and for our listeners about how we should be as attorneys preparing our experts for their depth testimony and or for trial testimony? You know, we just talked a little bit about the expert preparing the attorney to depose someone. Now, if we switch the roles, how can the attorney best prepare his or her expert for testimony?
Now, let me give you some thoughts. First, make the expert prepare. Some people like to wing things, and sometimes that is born of a sort of a false pride or confidence as to what they know. They are experts after all, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be preparing for the deposition. Practically, tell the expert where the deposition will be held. If by Zoom, for example, well, tell him or her that. When it starts, when you want the expert to be online or at the place where the deposition will be, how to get there, and how many minutes in advance of the deposition you want the person to be there. If the deposition will be recorded in particular, you want to tell the expert, dress up. In our current culture, there is such a mixed vibe about what is business attire. It is not uncommon for me now to be giving a deposition. I'm the only person wearing a suit or business formal attire in the room, and everyone else is fine with that. But if I had shown up in a golf shirt, that would be bad because I'm being recorded, and the jury may see that testimony later. But the expert may not know that. And so you just have to tell people all these practical things. If there's a time limit for the depo, tell the person what the time limit is. Now, if it's, say, a 7-hour time limit, and this is kind of a big deal case, well, prepare the expert. You may be going 7 hours, which really, as with a football game, it's not really 7 hours. It's more like 9 hours. That also helps the expert plan travel. If the person needs to go out of town, explain things about the opposing counsel. What is the demeanor of that lawyer? Is he or she explosive, sarcastic, mean, or extremely bright? Ask extremely good questions or ask extremely tricky questions, or ask questions that sound right, but that fail to include a certain important thing, trying to get the expert to agree with the question that could be used later. All those kinds of things about who the other lawyer is. If your expert talks a lot, tell that person to shut up. In a deposition, if the question to me is a yes or no question, unless I need to say something more to avoid giving the soundbite, my answer is yes or no. And there's a reason for that. And whenever experts say too much, they get into strange territory that could hurt them. So if your person is naturally glib, tell the person, remember, in this deposition, this is not a conversation. If there's a mistake in the report, no matter how big or small it is, make sure the expert is warned of that and just talk about how the expert should deal with that. If there's any document that has not been supplied to the expert or had not been as of the time the report was written, but that is now important to the case, give that to the expert in prep for the deposition. Also, if there's a substantive area of the law that the expert should really understand about this state, particularly if the expert is from out of state, for example, the duty to defend in the state of New Jersey, well, supply the expert with some law on the duty to defend so that he or she can refresh on that subject. If there's a subpoena ducis tecum for the expert's file, figure out how to work that out, exactly what will be produced and when. Take breaks. I was in a deposition not so long ago where we went typically about 2 hours between breaks. The lawyer who was defending me was not insisting on taking breaks every hour. Well, okay, I'm 67. Most of the experts that I know about title are older than me, not younger than me. I have to tell you this, that giving a deposition is very hard work, much harder than taking a deposition. Your expert needs breaks. So make sure that you get breaks. Make sure that you feed the expert at lunchtime. I have had way too many candy bars for lunch. That's not good for your case. Because if the expert is hungry, that's not a good thing. Okay. And if the expert is traveling for the deposition, just be like a host and tell the expert, here would be a good hotel. When I go to Los Angeles, I ask which airport, which of the 5 airports should I fly into? Because that's a big deal. That kind of thing.
Now, one thing I want to circle back on. You had mentioned earlier, if your expert is naturally glib. So any additional tips you can give us? Because I think there's a fine line between being very respectful of your expert. And normally when we're dealing with an expert, it is someone who is very well respected in the field and someone who's very revered in our field, et cetera. So you want to be respectful, but at the same time, when you have someone that's naturally glib, it could make a very bad impression on the judge or the jury, and it could hurt your case. And it might be someone that is extremely bright and has a great opinion, but they get on the stand, and if they come off as glib, that could hurt your case. So any advice that you have on how we can handle that ahead of time without insulting our expert, I guess, is how to nicely say, hey, don't be yourself up there.
Well, actually, I think with the glib person, the thing is you have to tell that person, do not be yourself in the deposition or on the stand. Do not. You need to become a different person. And you need to be concise and precise. Do not go beyond the bounds of what that requires. And if that means being a whole different person, then that's what you need to do for the sake of my case, my client, who is also your client, but also the defense of your opinions. Because if you start saying stuff that just wasn't in the script, well, then they're going to ask you about that, and you're going to wind up getting skewered for that stuff. You can defend your opinions, but you're not going to be able to defend the extra stuff you're throwing in. And I would just say it very bluntly.
Yeah. And I know when you were saying earlier about a yes or no question, there was an attorney early in my career who I stole this from, who we were prepping a witness, and he used the phrase, or the sample question, do you know who the first president of the United States was? And the answer to that question is yes. The answer to that question is not George Washington, because the question that was asked of you was a yes or no question. Do you know? And I remember that sticking with me, and now I use it when I'm prepping people. So credit to that attorney for giving me that sample question to use, but it's that same thing. It's a yes or no question. And I think, as you said earlier, sometimes you need more, because the yes or no question, they could trap you with it, and you might need the sound bite for you to clarify that yes or no. But if not, stick with that yes or no, and let's not be adding things that don't need to be added.
Exactly. And that is a great prep question or point to make.
I guess the last thing I have for you is whether or not you have any separate tips for trial testimony as opposed to deposition testimony.
Yes, I have a couple of really practical thoughts for you. Very practical, I think. First, if the trial date moves, tell the expert. Or better yet, if the court is considering moving the trial date, ask the expert, are you available on these certain dates that the court is considering? I have gotten boxed in where the trial date was moved, and then I was told that it had been moved, and then I was not available on the new date. I had been available and protecting the old date. If you settle the case, or the case is decided on a summary judgment motion, I think the courteous thing is to tell the expert, this case is over, or at least your part of it is over. We don't need you anymore. Thank you very much. I don't think that lawyers realize that experts keep in the back of their minds the cases that they're working on, and that they assume that cases that they haven't heard about recently are still going. Anyway, let the expert know that it's gone. When you get close to the trial, tell the witness exactly what courthouse you're going to. This is a recurring thing for me. What courthouse do I show up at to testify? Also, when I get to that, where do I park? When I get into the courthouse, what is the name of the judge? And what is the number on the courtroom? It's funny, you know, you're so used to going into that courtroom, you don't think about this, but the expert has never been there before. So you got to tell him or her all that.
I'm laughing because we recently had a trial, and in order to get someone to the courthouse, we were in a separate courthouse than the main courthouse. So I literally drew a map. I went on Google Maps and I printed something and I circled, this is the best parking garage for you to park in. And I sent it out with all of these maps that I took offline and then circled with my little drawings. And this is where you should park. This is the building you want to go to. Don't go to the main courthouse. And here's what you do. And I went with the step-by-step, because exactly that. I mean, we'd been on trial for quite a while, so it was second nature to us. We knew exactly where we were going. But I was thinking, this person's coming to this courthouse for the first time today. We don't want them being late because they went to the other courthouse or parked miles away when this is the closest garage, et cetera. So I think that is very important.
Exactly. Also, if the witness is going to be sequestered, tell the expert that in advance, at least as far in advance as you know, and then arrange where that person's going to be sitting or waiting to be called in as a witness at the time he or she will testify. I have seen cases in which the lawyer came shooting out for the expert who was about to testify, and the expert wasn't there, and they couldn't find the expert. Well, that's kind of embarrassing. So I always work that out. And sequestration, obviously, is a very important thing, and you have to honor it. I have a throat lozenge in my mouth right now. I don't have a strong voice that lasts a long time. Before I testify, I put a throat lozenge in my mouth, and it does wonders in keeping my throat good in testifying. What you should tell the expert, especially if this person hasn't done this a lot, is there's going to be a lot of pressure on the stand, and you could feel very nervous suddenly, especially during cross. What we don't want is for you to lose your voice or to start coughing or perspiring or whatever on cross, because it will look like you don't know how to answer these questions. So years ago, I learned when I was giving speeches that I needed to use a throat lozenge. I learned that long time ago. This works for me. I think you should have a throat lozenge available. Give it to the expert before he or she goes up onto the stand, or a couple of them. And then that's the cue. Okay, this is something you can do. Also provide some water. Although actually, cold water is not good for your voice. And cold water, frequent speakers will tell you, is bad for speaking. If your speaking is already bad, drinking cold water will make it worse. I've studied this.
That's a great tip about the lozenge. I'm going to try it. I give various speeches and speak at various events, and next time I'm going to have a lozenge in my mouth. I like it.
There's no harm in it. You see, it's the thing that can only help.
Unless you spit it out, Bush.
Well, true, true. But I'll give you one other thought. I think of the direct testimony at trial of the expert as a script in a play. Because the expert already knows what he or she has his opinions. But what matters is, what are the questions that you will ask that leads the expert to give the particular opinions? You have to be in sync with the expert on that. So if you're asking questions that the expert doesn't really quite understand, then the expert doesn't know, well, is the lawyer seeking this opinion or that opinion? Or is this kind of a lead-up question? Now, I am a little bit OCD on all of this. So I write out the questions and the answers in advance. And I ask lawyers, please ask these questions exactly as written, because when I hear this question, that will be my cue to give this answer. There's nothing wrong with this. This is how a person gives good testimony as an expert. You're not a fact witness. You're there to give opinions. You need to give them smoothly so that there are no big hiccups in it. That's the most important thing in being smooth about it. Write it out. Also, force the expert to write out his or her answers. It's a good exercise anyway. And then the expert can memorize the answers so that the testimony goes in well. Oh, the expert should also reread his or her deposition testimony at least once before testifying at trial, because that's what will be used on cross. And I testified in a trial a little while ago where there was a very good lawyer on the other side, and he wanted to use certain pieces of my testimony with the jury to get me to look like I was agreeing with them. I knew my testimony from deposition well enough to say each time, yes, but you're not giving my complete answer that I gave to that question. And my complete answer was, that's important for your case.
That sort of leads up the question I have, Bush. How do attorneys work with and how do you prepare to address cross-examination?
I think the best way to do it, particularly if the witness doesn't have a lot of experience on the stand, is to do a mock cross-examination. You know what the cross-exam will likely be like. Well, go ahead and do it all the way through. Don't skip it. Don't shortcut it. Go all the way through. Talk through what you expect the question to be and also what you assume the witness will say.
Great. I don't have any more questions. Bethany, do you have any?
No, I think that's it. It's all been extremely helpful. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you this morning and getting all of these tips that I'm going to make sure we pass on to all of the rest of our team in connection, which all of the rest of our team should be listening to our podcast and get these tips. But really, it's been extremely helpful for all of us. And as I said earlier, I'm fangirling a bit. So it's been a pleasure meeting you this morning as well. So thank you for being on here and for answering all of our questions. Really appreciate it.
And Bush, my pleasure. We were so excited to have you. I forgot to sort of give you a proper introduction. Bush, you're a partner at Reinhart, Borner, and Van Doren. I know you worked at Chicago Title, but you've been at Reinhart now for, is it 2 decades now, Bush? Or?
Yes, about 24 years.
And your treatise that we read and refer to is the author of the Title and Escrow Claims Guide, but I know you've written, a lot of other presentations, closing protection letters, and I'm looking at your bio, and I think it said 3,000 articles. Apologize for not giving you the proper introduction at the beginning. So we'll wrap it up at the end and say it's been fantastic having you.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. We just ended our first interview with Bush Nielsen, one of the preeminent experts in title insurance. And now we're going to have our case of the podcast with Kevin Hackinson. And Kevin is going to talk about an interesting case called Palau v. Scalia, which deals in part with the intersection of family law, real estate, and joint tenancies. So with that, Kevin, why don't you give us a little bit about the facts of the suit and what came about and what's in the background so our audience can understand.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike. And, you know, before I begin, yeah, great that you were able to interview Mr. Nielsen. As an associate at the firm, often tasked with researching title insurance issues, we see his name all the time, obviously. So yeah, this matter, Palau v. Scalia, is a matter that originating property in Westford, Massachusetts, near and dear to my heart, because I'm from Massachusetts, and Westford is part of the Merrimack Valley, as we call it, the same area that I grew up in. So I was interested to see this case come across. Dealt with property in Westford, and this particular suit arose based on a refinance of a property that the current owner was doing. To get into the background of the case, though, it originally stems from ownership of the property from 1993, where Gregory Bohenko, his wife Christine Bohenko, and Christine's mother Priscilla Scalia bought property in October of 1993, and they took title of this property as joint tenants, which was written right into the deed to the property that they got, that they would be joint tenants, said that very clearly in the deed. Christine and Gregory got divorced about 10 years later in the early 2000s, and the divorce resulted in, as part of their divorce settlement, Gregory deeded all of his right title and interest in this particular property to Christine, his now ex-wife, as part of the settlement. So there was a deed from Gregory to Christine that was part of that settlement. About 10 years later, in 2012, Priscilla, who was the mother of Christine, she died, 2012, and she left a will that left her interest in the property to her children, but only if she had an interest in the property. And specifically what her will said was, but only if she had an interest in that property at the time of her passing. Then about 6 years later, 2018, Christine, who at that point was, you know, now the at least perceived as the sole owner of the property, she sold the property to Sona Palau, who again is the plaintiff in this matter. And again, a couple of years later, Ms. Palau went to do a refinance of the property, and an attorney for the lender of the refinancer alerted her to a possible title issue with the property, which led her to bring a lawsuit to quiet title to the property.
All right. And what was the title issue that was raised?
Yeah, so the title issue that was raised was related back to that 2002 deed. If you recall, that was the deed from Gregory to Christine after they got divorced, and he deeded all of his right title and interest in the property to Christine at that time. And the perceived title issue was that because he did that at that time, it destroyed the joint tenancy between the three of them, meaning that there was no joint tenancy after the divorce, and basically caused some changes to the ownership of the property that may result in others potentially having title to the property.
Right. We'll get into the trial court decision, but I noticed that the court cited this case called Battle, which says a joint tenancy is out of Massachusetts, probably the Massachusetts Supreme Court, I think, which says a joint tenancy is severed when any one of the four unities, the unity of interest, the unity of title, the unity of time, and the unity of possession, is destroyed, including due to a unilateral act of one of the parties. And that's sort of what was at issue in this trial court decision and the appeal. And with that, what did the trial court decide?
Yeah, so the trial court, you know, made a few different findings as part of this. First of all, one of the issues that had been raised was whether or not there was a joint tenancy at all to begin with, you know, beginning in 1993 when the Bohenkos had originally purchased the property. But the trial court found that there was joint tenancy, that it was established at that time by the very clear language of that deed in 1993, which said that these three people were taking the property as joint tenants. What they found further was that as to that 2002 deed from Gregory to Christine that we were just speaking about, trial court found that it did, that that deed did indeed sever the joint tenancy among the three who originally took title of the property. But it found that there was no dispute, clearly no dispute, that the intention of the parties was for Christine and her mother, Priscilla, to maintain their joint tenancy to the property. And as such, what they did is they reformed that deed to make it clear that Christine and Priscilla maintained ownership to the property as joint tenants. Trial court also found that the plaintiff in this case was a bona fide purchaser of the property. Didn't really go into much detail about his analysis in this decision, but it did find that that was the case. And then the defendants to this matter, who were the children of Priscilla, they appealed the decision.
And what happened on appeal?
So on appeal, the appellate court essentially upheld the findings of the trial court, although there was one aspect of it. The appellate court differed slightly, and I'll get into that in a moment. You know, the first thing that they found is they upheld the decision of the trial court, which found that the 1993 deed conveyed the property as joint tenants. Again, they found that original deed very clearly stated that the property was being taken by Priscilla, Christine, and Gregory as joint tenants. The clear language of the deed stated that. The defendants had raised some sort of issue to suggest the fact that the as joint tenants portion of the conveyance of the property was handwritten into the right margin of the deed. There appeared to be some argument that, the fact that it was handwritten and that it was in the margin somehow changed the importance of those words. The appellate court rejected that argument. They said, no, the very, very clear language, doesn't matter that it's handwritten or that it's within the margin. The more interesting piece was regarding the 2002 deed, which again, that was the deed from Gregory to Christine. As I mentioned a moment ago, the trial court agreed with defendants that it severed the joint tenancy between, you know, between the three parties, but instead reformed the deed so that it would basically fulfill the intent of the parties, at least as they saw it. What was interesting about the appellate decision is they basically said, you know, let's hold on a minute here, trial court and all parties who seem to agree that the joint tenancy was severed. The appellate court wasn't so sure about that. They basically questioned whether the trial court was correct in determining that. And they cited case law that suggests that where there are more than two joint tenants in a, you know, in a joint tenancy, a conveyance by one tenant does not necessarily affect the joint tenancy among all tenants. They cited a Massachusetts case called Foster v. Smith, a 1912 case. And I believe they also cited some cases from other jurisdictions as well that supported that, you know, that finding. Kind of interesting that they're pretty old cases that they're citing. Perhaps nothing all that recent that dealt with this sort of issue, but interesting that they cited a couple of different, you know, cases from different jurisdictions. Ultimately, they didn't affirmatively say that the joint tenancy was or wasn't severed, though, because what they ultimately concluded was that the trial court's decision to reform the deed to, you know, to conform to the intent of the parties was proper, that the reformation of a deed is available when, you know, language in a, you know, a deed doesn't reflect the true intent of the parties. And they found that that's exactly what the case was here, that there was no evidence that there was any intent by any party to sever the joint tenancy between Christine and Priscilla. And that as such, the proper end result was achieved here by the reformation of the deed. You know, the last thing that they did is they agreed with the trial court that the plaintiff was a bona fide purchaser for value. Basically, the argument by the defendants was that if the plaintiff should have been on notice that there was a potential issue with title here because of that 2002 deed from Gregory to Christine. And the appellate court rejected that. They said that this plaintiff got title searches as part of her purchase of the property in 2018, and then again as part of her refinancing of the property in 2021, and that neither of those title searches revealed any potential issues with title. And they said that basically to be on notice of an issue with title, a basic general course of business search would have had to have, you know, revealed an issue like that. And because that was simply not the case here, they found that she was a bona fide purchaser for value.
You know, what also I found interesting too is the defendants included Christine Bohenko.
Yes.
She was the child of Priscilla. And it doesn't say whether she actively pursued trying to invalidate a deed that she agreed to, but she is definitely listed as one of the defendants and had to be a
double. Yeah. Yeah, that you're absolutely right about that. And that was something that I think I caught a little bit in my sort of third or fourth reading of this. It is interesting because one of the main pieces of evidence that the appellate court leans on to say that the trial court fulfilled the intent of the parties is an affidavit from Christine when she sold the property in 2018 that said, to my knowledge, I am the only owner of this property, that I took title of this property when my mother died in 2012. And that was basically all of the evidence. There was no evidence on the other side. That was sort of the entire breadth of the evidence here, was that affidavit from her. Yeah, you know, I thought that was interesting too. I also thought it was interesting that this case went to appeal at all. I have to wonder what the intention of the defendants was in appealing it, because again, it seems like at the end of the day, the trial court clearly fulfilled what the parties set out to do. And I'm sort of wondering what they were angling for with this appeal.
Well, one thing we do know, we can blame it on the brother, because one of the other footnotes notes that Christine and the unknown heirs were not parties to the appeal. So to me, it kind of looks like Christine really didn't contest this, and it was the brother who was trying to get a windfall.
Hard to imagine it's anything else.
All right. Anything else about this case, Kevin? It really is an interesting case because you got family law, you got joint tenancies. Usually it's not a husband and wife, it's three. It's a neat little fact pattern for title nerds.
It absolutely is. You know, it's always nice when you've got title issues here. You've got some interesting family dynamics to kind of think about what's going on here. You know, you've got some classic law school legal issues to think about here too, for sure.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. And with that, this ends the first episode of season 3 of Title Nerds. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening today to Title Nerds, presented by Riker Danzig. If you like this show, please remember to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred podcast app and be sure to rate us 5 stars. You may also wish to subscribe to our blog and visit our website at riker.com. We hope you will join us again for another episode of Title Nerds.